We are back. Our guest is Walter Truitt Anderson, who does have a doctorate, so I might call him doctor. We were talking about exponential growth, exponential changes, and that's part of why it feels like things are changing so much faster than maybe we thought they used to change, although I'm not sure now that you say that.
Well, you know, it was gracious of you to say that I would give you the answer to the question of whether we can handle it or not.
I'm waiting.
I can say two things which are somewhat contradictory. One is that nobody can give you the answer, because the answer will only come with time. The answer does not exist in anybody's head or anybody's wonderful book. We'll find out as we go along whether we can, in fact, deal with this kind of change or not. My hunch, which is not the same as an answer, is that we can, because I am increasingly convinced that we have never kind of mined the depth or scanned the breadth of what human intelligence is and what human life is, and I think we may find out that we're capable of more than we thought. That's a hunch, though. I stress that.
I want to pick up on a thread that you offered me as we began. The way I found you was I was in a bookstore, and I saw a book called The Truth About the Truth. And I thought, there's a thought.
A modest agenda.
And I was captivated. In the course of reading some of your work, you talk about how important language is as a tool, and it seems to me, having read a little of your work, that we really need to talk about this incredible tool that humans have, that it really has a lot to do with who we are and who we might be, and this big change in the evolutionary.
I think that's quite true. It's been several decades now since philosophy took what they call the linguistic turn, and people begin to seriously try to wrestle with how central language is to our very existence. And then more recently, the cognitive scientists have paid a lot of attention to...
The guys who are looking at brains?
The guys who are looking at brains recognize that a large part of, you might say, the software of the functioning human brain is language. But we have yet a long way to go, I think, in figuring out how we use language and how language uses us. And I see the world, in a sense, being driven by descriptions, people calling themselves, Serbs or Kosovars or mm-hmm. whatever you want, without recognizing that those are more verbal behaviors than they are descriptions of any particular genetic or other physical reality. We live within language to a tremendous extent and don't quite know it yet.
You also say that it really shapes the kind of animal that we are. I think I almost have the quote accurate at that point.
Probably do.
That it really is central to what we are, not yeah. just who we are. Most yes. of us don't think about that. I mean, it's just, it's language.
Yeah, and because we don't think about it, we go around throwing words at one another and descriptions at one another and having a very hard time coming to grips as a species with that. And I think that it's like there are certain kind of skills that we have yet to learn in order to kind of use language and not entirely be, as I say, used by it. I would, for example, encourage people to just develop, as a first step in that direction, an intense sensitivity toward the verb to be.
Mm.
And what does it mean?
That's a pretty fundamental one.
But just think about it. What does it mean when you say, I am Catholic, or he is, I'll leave it blank,
yeah.
A
to
whatever.
To be, yeah.
What does that mean? What kind of a behavior are you engaging in? What kind of reality about that person or that thing does that statement really reflect? And I think if you just kind of play around with that a little bit...
And it has huge implications, doesn't
enormous,
it?
That also
yes.
goes to the... It's interesting you say it that way, to the foundations of at least Western philosophy. I mean,
absolutely.
Essentially, that's the root of metaphysics, or at least half the root of metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably it is in that You also wrote another book called The Future of the Self, another modest agenda. But in that context, you know, you put these two together and you know, starting with at least the Greek philosophers in the Western tradition, looking at the being question, the I question, mm-hmm. the ontological question, and then bring that forward to what, I mean, they were as much as anything trying to understand themselves and understand the relationship between themselves and the world around them, mm-hmm. which I think is what you're suggesting we're still struggling with, but we have a different set of tools. And to go back to that evolutionary question, how do you see that playing itself out?
Well, I think part of the evolutionary chore that we're sort of all in the midst of, that we're going to have to complete in order to proceed to grow up as a species or even to become maybe responsible adolescents, is to understand those things and to understand, for example, that, as you mentioned, throughout Western civilization, at least since Plato and Socrates, people have accepted the premise that a self is something essential and separate from its descriptions, from the words that we say to ourselves and to others that say what we are. And
it's something we can identify and put our fingers on, and it's quite tactile almost.
Right. But it's still a fairly revolutionary thought, at least in the West, although it's central to Buddhism and other you might call spiritual traditions, that the self, that any permanent self does not exist, and that you get yourself in serious psychological trouble when you begin to believe that it does.
Well, in a sense, Heraclitus lost out to Plato and Aristotle.
Absolutely.
You know, people sometimes are tempted to think that philosophy is just sort of a silly hobby a few people have. But all of these issues really affect John and Jane on the street, don't they?
I think they do, and
I mean, they don't know about Heraclitus and probably couldn't care less.
Yeah, and then the unfortunate thing is that a lot of the philosophers don't know about John and Jane on the street, nor do they care very much.
So maybe there's a middle ground to be found here.
Well, I think there is. I think that one of the things that we continually have to keep doing is learning how to wrestle with big ideas in a kind of a public way.
You're also suggesting that one of the applications of language is communication between perhaps the philosophers.
Even philosophers and real people?
I don't mean to push this too far, but
it would be nice.
Well, tell me how you see this affecting those of us who don't spend our time thinking of philosophical things, which is everybody else.
Well, it affects us in so many ways that I don't think we have time for it. But to stay with a theme we've already kind of opened up, it affects our ideas about what we think we are, and it affects our ideas about how important other people's descriptions of us are. There really are, I think, deep changes that take place in a human being as you begin to kind of see your way around the corner of some of the linguistic issues that seem so...
Deep changes and linguistic issues. Which one do you want first?
They're not mutually exclusive.
I'd say they're inseparable.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Psychotherapy, after all, is a lot of talk.
Yeah.
And...
That in a sense, I think, is, you know, there is an alienation. I have friends who, when you start talking about these kinds of things, will just leave. I mean, mm-hmm. Literally, they will either psychologically check out or will physically leave the room. But to make this personal, you know, we're talking about our sense of ourselves, and there's nothing much more personal than our sense of ourselves. And you're suggesting, I think, and if I understand what you've written, that sense of self is undergoing a dramatic change, partly on the basis of language, but more substantially on the basis of the changes in the world around us, the context we inhabit.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us back to Jack and Jane, or whatever their names are.
They're changing. The names are changing.
Because there are a lot of people who are essentially wrestling with the big philosophical concepts, but they're doing it in their daily lives, and they don't know they're doing it. They don't know how much they've changed, in a way.
But they might feel pain as they do it.
They may feel pain because they may think it's really weird. They may think it's really weird to go through three or four major changes in your life when you change your beliefs and change your lifestyle and change your mate and change your occupation, which a lot of people do. And some people seem to be able to feel pretty good about it, and a lot of other people have a great deal of trouble with it. But I'm suggesting that a lot of people are kind of learning the what you might call the postmodern skills out there, and they don't call it that, which may be just as well.
It probably is.
But there's an awful lot of wrestling with meaning and identity and all those kinds of things that happens all the time in people's lives. And there's a lot of wrestling with kind of profound issues where people make adjustments in things that you might call epistemological. I remember one time I was talking about things like this with a woman who was very religious, and I said several kind of negative things about absolute beliefs, which I tend to do. And she was very agitated and upset by this, and she said, my faith is absolute. Those are absolutely the things I live by and for and believe. And I said, would you expect me to believe the same things? And she said, well, of course not. Uh-huh. That's, you know, your beliefs are your, well, that's a profound understanding and fairly new, yeah. You know, yeah. For somebody to make that kind of adjustment.
Bill, just a second. This is Walter Truitt Anderson, Bill Russell. He and I will all be back. We are in San Francisco. We welcome you being with us when we return in just a moment.